From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, sanctions threaten London's secretive Russian oligarchs. A discussion of the crisis in Syria.
After 3 years of protests and conflict, both sides have been driven to extremes.
Nagging questions about Iran's ties to Al-Qaeda. And the missed 3 million, who are they? It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. The United States today reaffirmed its commitment to the Ukrainian leadership. In a joint statement, the two countries described Russia's attempt to annex Crimea as illegal and vowed not to recognize the move. The statement said Russia's actions undermine the foundation of the global security architecture and endanger European peace and security. Ukraine's Secretary for National Security told VOA that about 100,000 Russian troops and armor are poised along Ukrainian borders and remain on full alert. Moscow insists the border troops are conducting maneuvers. During the past decade, London has proved a magnet for rich Russians buying prime real estate, often spending tens of millions of dollars. But the billions of rubles that pour into the city of London could be under threat as Britain weighs economic sanctions against Russia following Moscow's annexation of Crimea. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
In London's wealthy districts of Kensington and Chelsea, street names like Moscow Road and St. Petersburg Place point to the historic appeal for wealthy Russians. Parts of the city are affectionately known as Londongrad by Russian residents. Much of the allure stems from the security London affords, says Nicholas Redman of the International Institute for Strategic Studies.
We have a court system here and property rights system in Britain, which you just don't have the equivalent of in Russia. And so people that have made money in Russia sometimes like to have a base here and places like here in order to feel more secure in the future.
That security is under question as Britain draws up stronger economic sanctions against Russia in case of further incursions into Ukraine. The City of London is a hub for Russian businesses pursuing global trade. Nearly 70 Russian companies are listed on London's stock markets, including energy giants Rosneft and Gazprom. But the threat of sanctions has caused the postponement of at least two stock offerings as the appetite for Russian securities has fallen, says Moscow-born Sergei Ostrovsky from the Russia division of global law firm Ashurst.
There will be a period of caution while people put on hold projects which can be put on hold, adopt a wait-and-see position, and where they will be cautious to take on new projects. In the long term, it is difficult to see an easy replacement for the City of London where Russian business is concerned.
Prime London property is another favoured investment. Real estate agents highlight the $39 million sale in 2012 of a 12-bedroom house in Kensington, complete with cinema and swimming pool, the ideal investment for a Russian oligarch. Broker Ed Mead is executive director of real estate agent Douglas & Gordon.
The secrecy laws here allow you to buy a property in an offshore or a company name. You pay an enhanced stamp duty, and I think they quite like the anonymity that provides them.
Russia's President Vladimir Putin relies on the support of influential oligarchs with lots of money parked in London, says analyst Nicholas Redman of the International Institute for Strategic Studies.
If large members of the Russian elite are being seriously inconvenienced, if their wealth is being wiped out, if they are no longer welcome in the kind of places that they are used to going in, then it's reasonable to assume that their loyalty would at least be tested.
Sanctions would not have an immediate effect on Russia's wider economy, says Elizabeth Stevens of insurance brokers Jardine Lloyd Thompson.
We've seen with Iran, we saw with Iraq under Hussein, it takes many years for that to come to fruition. And in the interim, the EU would hurt their own economies as well.
Analysts say that trade-off is being debated in capitals across Europe, none more so than in London. Henry Ridgewell, the VOA News, London.
This month marks the third anniversary of the beginning of the conflict in Syria. As tensions mount over Russia's actions in Crimea, Moscow may be even less likely to pressure its ally, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, to make concessions. So what to do about the devastating humanitarian, economic, and strategic consequences of the civil war in Syria? Andrew Tabler, senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and Valerie Sabala, research analyst at the Institute for the Study of War, discuss the issue with VOA's Carol Castiel.
Here we are, Andrew Tabler. We had the Geneva so-called peace conference ending in a stalemate. Either side can't even agree on the interpretation of the document in Geneva. One side, of course, the U.S., the West, and the opposition saying that Assad has to go and there has to be a transition. And, of course, Assad, Russia, and Iran saying not so fast. So they disagree even on the premise. Where do we go from here?
It's really hard to tell, sadly. After 3 years of protests and conflict, both sides have been driven to extremes. The regime and its brutality and using conventional and non-conventional weapons such as poison gas, Scud missiles, and so on, has absolutely brought out the worst in the opposition, who's been fighting back, begging for international intervention, and has plunged the country, as Anne's article depicts, into the abyss. The real problem that we have in front of us isn't just a humanitarian disaster. That is well over 140,000 killed, almost half the Syrian population of 22, 23 million displaced. But there's just no end in sight to the conflict, no international agreement on what the parameters of a settlement would look like, and no agreement in the region between the two backers, Iran on the side of the Assad regime, Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states on the side of the opposition. So I'm afraid 2014 could be even more grim than 2013, and that's really saying something.
Let me get Valerie Sabala to weigh in. No question it's a humanitarian disaster, but as Andrew Tabler suggests, it's a strategic disaster as well for the region. We have really at hand a proxy war between Assad, his regime, and his Iranian and Russian backers on the one hand, and of course the Sunni Gulf states trying to repel and resist Iranian aggression. So where do you see things going?
Like Andrew, it's very hard to say. The proxy war has been evident for a long time, and unfortunately, the lack of real hard action on our part or on the part of the West has further empowered and enabled Russian and Iranian action in the conflict. And they've both, I think, strengthened their positions in the region strategically. So that's going to make it harder as things move forward for any real solution to occur.
Back to you, Andrew Tabler, back to the so-called Geneva process. The way we hear Assad talking in Russia, it seems as if that's really not going anywhere anymore. He's talking about, that is, Bashar al-Assad holding elections, almost surreal when you think about it, in a country that's racked by war. Is there any hope, or is this process pretty much dead?
The Geneva process is dead. It doesn't mean that some kind of diplomatic process is impossible. The magic number here is 97. Most Americans woke up this week and found that 97% of Crimeans had supposedly voted to join Russia, a strong backer of the Assad regime. 97 is also a magic number in Syria. 97.62% was the percentage that supposedly voted for Bashar in the last Syrian presidential referendum, which I witnessed in Syria. You know, Syrian elections are a joke. They're the butt of jokes in the Arab world. They're the most manipulated, if not the most manipulated, in the region. And what makes this particularly ironic for Syrians is that after all this conflict, this is the solution that Bashar al-Assad is holding out: contested elections for president under his leadership. And, of course, the reason why that's a problem is that it makes it extremely unlikely that you could fold the opposition into that election cycle. You could perhaps bandwagon some of them into it, but it's not going to lead to a real settlement in the country. And I think that is the big problem at the moment, because a lack of a settlement, a real settlement, means that the country couldn't remain divided for some time. And in this case, legally, when Bashar wins re-election, it would be for another 7-year term as president.
And Valerie Sabala, in terms of the process in Geneva, would you also agree that it's dead, or do you see any kind of diplomatic process on the horizon, given the situation, the tensions between the United States and Russia over Ukraine, and the situation on the ground in Syria?
No, I think Geneva's dead. I kind of think it was always a little bit farcical based on a read of the parties involved. I'd like to also comment on the elections. I'm not sure everyone in the U.S. and abroad understands how sham these elections are or will be, because we hear the word elections and we think democracy. So not even the historical record of these elections having one candidate that you have to vote for, pretty much a rubber stamp. But recently the regime has taken legal actions to make them even more unwinnable by anyone other than Assad. We saw a headline a couple days ago or weeks ago saying that the regime legalized other candidates, but they also pretty much prevented every opposition member from running in the elections. They're reissuing ID cards. They closed embassies of countries that have refugees, so Syrians can't vote. I mean, they're really taking great lengths to ensure there's no chance.
Mallory Zabala with the Institute for the Study of War and Andrew Tabler with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. You can hear more of their conversation with Carol Castiel by visiting our website at voanews.com and looking under the Programs tab for Encounter. U.S. officials and lawmakers continue to eye Iran with suspicion, even though an interim nuclear agreement was reached with Tehran and ongoing negotiations on a final deal are underway. And while Tehran's support of the terrorist group Hezbollah and its backing of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad have been well documented, VOA's Jeff Seldon reports there are still nagging questions about Tehran's mysterious ties to al-Qaeda, perhaps the most notorious terrorist group of all.
A smile from Iranian President Hassan Rouhani. Joyful handshakes after talks with world powers. These are the images Iran wants the world to see. But there are those who believe it's just a facade. A view bolstered again when the U.S. Treasury Department designated an Iran-based terrorist, Jafar al-Uzbeki, as a key al-Qaeda facilitator, funneling a significant amount of money from Iran into Afghanistan and Pakistan. U.S. officials have also linked al-Uzbeki to Yassin al-Suri, head of al-Qaeda's Iran network, one of a handful of operatives identified in recent years responsible for getting al-Qaeda fighters into Syria. The apparent union of sorts between two opposing branches of Islam, Shiite Iran and Sunni al-Qaeda, is reason to worry for lawmakers like Adam Schiff on the House Intelligence Committee.
We see a relationship between Iran and al-Qaeda that at times is difficult to figure out because on the one hand they would be natural adversaries, but in that part of the world, terrorism makes strange bedfellows.
Yet al-Qaeda-linked groups continue to target Iran, including an attack late last year on Tehran's embassy in Lebanon, killing 23 people, including a cultural attaché. Iran analyst Trita Parsi.
Ultimately, the enmity between Iran and al-Qaeda is almost deeper than the enmity between the United States and al-Qaeda. But Iran is stuck in the region, and as a result, sometimes it does strike small deals in order to actually protect itself or to advance its interests in other ways.
Yet the history between Iran and al-Qaeda goes back decades. Investigators looking at the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks on the U.S. pointing to discussions in Sudan between al-Qaeda and Iranian operatives in the early 1990s. There's also the deadly 1996 attack on Khobar Towers, a residential complex housing Americans in Saudi Arabia, and information suggesting Iran gave passage to the 9/11 hijackers. 9/11 Commission member and former CIA operative Mike Hurley was among those urging U.S. intelligence officials to investigate further.
I don't have a good sense, and I don't know that there has been kind of deep, active pursuit and investigation of that. I think it may be an area where the government has fallen down to some extent.
More recently, Canadian investigators tied a 2013 plot to derail a train to al-Qaeda in Iran, a charge Iran denies. Jonathan Shanzer at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies worries about what it all means for the ongoing nuclear negotiations between the U.S. and Iran.
Iran's playing three-dimensional chess. They continue to work with their natural allies, or with their adversaries, and sometimes with their enemies. This is a very dangerous regime that we're playing with, and I don't believe we're playing on equal footing.
When questioned, State Department officials focus mainly on Iran's ties to Hezbollah. But a senior U.S. official says some of al-Qaeda's facilitators in Iran are, quote, operating with the knowledge of Iranian authorities, though the official also says that doesn't mean Iran's necessarily aware of everything al-Qaeda is planning. Jeff Seldon, VOA News, Washington.
U.S. news outlets say the Obama administration will propose new legislation that will ban the National Security Agency from the collection and storing of massive amounts of Americans' phone records. Under the proposal, the government will have to obtain permission from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court to obtain data from phone companies on calls connected to suspected terrorists. The phone companies will be required to provide the NSA with updated information if any new phone calls are made to or from that number. Phone companies would not be required to maintain the phone call records for any longer than they do now. President Barack Obama launched a review of the NSA's phone surveillance program after former contractor Edward Snowden leaked details of the program, setting off a firestorm.
What is it like to study in the United States, and what do you have to do to get here? The Student Union is VOA's blog that follows students from all over the world as they face challenges and opportunities of studying at American universities. Log on at blogs.voanews.com/student-union.
Monday was World TB Day, when countries and organizations around the world commemorate global efforts to fight tuberculosis. Among the many groups helping TB patients is Project Hope, which has worked in more than 120 countries to make health care available for people. Dr. Christine Whalen is Project Hope's Senior Technical Director for Infectious Diseases. She has worked for more than 20 years helping people with TB. VOA's Steve Norman asked her about this year's World TB Day theme, the missed 3 million, and who they are.
We know that probably one-third of the world's population is infected with TB, and every year just under 9 million people become ill with TB. And of those people, many of them are indeed picked up by health systems, but we miss 3 million of these people. These people will go on to many of them will go on to transmit the disease and fall very, very ill, and some will succumb to that, their disease. So the missed 3 million, these are people who are often the most vulnerable of populations, who have difficult access to health care services, very vulnerable populations, for example, women and children, people who have less access living in remote rural areas where health care is few and far between. We also know that some of these 3 million are people living in both urban and rural areas, but because of the stigma associated with TB in many parts of the world, will be very reticent or hesitant to access services.
And what about Project Hope? Where does your organization come into this?
Yes, Project Hope has been working in healthcare for since 1958, and we have been very, very active in tuberculosis control for the past 20 years or so. We have programs in the Central Asian republics and also in a couple of countries in Africa, specifically Malawi and Namibia. Some of the work that we do, for example, in the Central Asian republics, we work at different levels. We work to support the national tuberculosis control programs to help them strengthen their programs. We work in the policy and the legal framework area because most of the services delivered in these countries have often been institutional-based or hospital-based. We support their efforts in decentralizing these services into primary health care level closer to the patients. We also work in supporting the laboratory, building laboratory capacity. And for those listeners, the laboratory is really the backbone of a tuberculosis control program. So with the laboratory, we're able to diagnose people who are affected by TB and provide them appropriate treatment. We also use the laboratory to ensure that patients are followed up regularly throughout their treatment to make sure that they're responding appropriately. And if not, can change their drug regimens as appropriate.
You mentioned earlier that there's a certain amount of stigma that goes along with TB. I guess therein lies an issue for people getting treatment. If they don't want to admit they have it, is it difficult to get them into a treatment program?
Many people, you know, when you talk to patients who are affected by TB, often it takes quite a bit of courage to come forth to the health center to be diagnosed, to receive the diagnosis of TB. People feel very isolated, and there's quite a bit of discrimination still in many countries about and around people who are affected by TB. Patients, their families are often less knowledgeable about TB and are not familiar on how to actually support their patient. Patients are often socially marginalized within their own communities because of a lack of awareness of TB in communities. TB is a curable disease, and the earlier that it's diagnosed and the earlier patients get on treatment, the better outcomes they will have. It's also very important to make sure that people who have a diagnosis of TB or who are suspected with TB are tested for HIV, because we know that HIV fuels TB. It's really a deadly duo. And we do have treatment, of course, for TB, and also patients with co-infection with HIV need life-saving antiretroviral therapy at the same time. So it's really important to diagnose these as soon as possible. And again, the earlier the treatment started, the better the patients tend to do.
Dr. Christine Wallen, Project Hope Senior Technical Director for Infectious Diseases. The World Meteorological Organization reports 2013 was the sixth warmest year on record, confirming long-term global warming is continuing. In its annual report on the status of the climate, WMO describes a pattern of extreme weather events across the planet. Lisa Schlein reports from the launch of the report in Geneva.
The World Meteorological Organization finds 13 of the 14 warmest years on record have occurred in the 21st century, and it says each of the last three decades has been warmer than the previous one, with 2001 to 2010 being the warmest decade on record. WMO Secretary General Michel Jarraud tells VOA it is important to look beyond individual years in order to assess the global warming trend. He says within this trend, there is significant variability in weather patterns, but he adds 2013 definitely confirms a continuation of this trend.
Since 2001, the first year of this new century, the coldest year that we have observed since 2001 is actually warmer than any year before 1998. So I don't think this can be used in seen in contradiction of the of a stop in the climate change. The climate change is not stopping.
Jarraud says the fact that parts of the United States and Canada were hit by very cold weather does not belie climate change, because many other places in the planet were hit with significantly warmer weather than usual. The WMO climate report highlights details of ice cover, ocean warming, sea level rise, and greenhouse gas concentrations. It says all these events are interrelated and indicate that climate is changing. It notes significant parts of the Asian continent saw more rain than usual last year, and it says the United Kingdom recorded the wettest winter in more than 250 years. It says Typhoon Haiyan, one of the strongest storms to ever make landfall, devastated parts of the central Philippines. The report says severe drought hit the western part of the U.S. state of California, as well as the Sahel in Africa and the southern African countries of Namibia, Botswana, and Angola. It says drought was linked to a record heat wave in Australia, which meteorologists confirm was due in large part to human activity. WMO's Jarraud says phenomena such as heavier precipitation, more intense heat, and more damage from storm surges and coastal flooding are consistent with what one would expect as a result of human-induced climate change. He says the state of the Arctic ice also is a concern.
What is worrying is that an increasing fraction of this ice is actually recent, new ice. This ice is normally very thin, and therefore it's more vulnerable to the variability and to the change in the climate. So this is the fact that the ice surface is a little bit more than the previous year is actually not in contradiction with the global warming. Actually, the volume continues to decrease. So we are still very much concerned about the evolution of the Arctic ice.
Jarraud says there is a strong possibility of an El Niño developing near the end of this year. El Niño is a complex interaction between the atmosphere and the ocean. If El Niño is confirmed, Jarraud says, the world can expect a warmer year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yockey in Washington.